Today's program is brought to you by Cain Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cain5.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio. And today is, what I like to say, another in my series of nostalgic, reminiscing kind of shows. And none other than some food from the 50s and 60s that Americans all know and I think have all tried probably at one time or another. But backing up a little bit, at the end, I'd say the end of the 19th century, the first wave of Italian immigrants were beginning to settle in America. And they, the wives in particular, the housewives, and the men who cooked too, were not finding the usual ingredients that they had at home to cook their dishes. So they sort of kind of had to put together and reinvent dishes with what they found. And then lo and behold, started importing things from Italy to create those dishes. And of course, we all know the story of, if you've seen the movie Big Night, you know, the excess of meats and abundance of natural ingredients and spaghetti and meatballs was born. And certainly, there is a name that then became popular that was many Americans' first introduction to Italian food. And that is Chef Boyardee. Now, unlike Betty Crocker or Aunt Jemima or so many of these other brands that took on personas, they weren't real people. But Chef Boyardee was definitely a real person. And I have with me in the studio the main chef, Hector of Ettore Boyardee, and his name was Boyardee. We'll get into all that as we talk to my guests. And my guest here with me is the great niece of the head chef and partner, granddaughter of his partner and brother. Her name is Anna Boyardee. Anna, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was kind of a convoluted introduction. I'm sorry, but I didn't want to give everything away in the introduction. But Chef Boyardee, we all know. In fact, I was telling some friends that the first time I ever made a pizza, probably at age, I don't know where I place it, age 10, 11, 12, something like that, was from a box mix of Chef Boyardee. And you know what? It wasn't half bad. I'd like to say that my pizza making has come a long way. But for someone growing up in the Midwest where we didn't have pizza parlors on every corner, this was a way to have, you know, and we didn't have frozen pizzas then to just stick in the oven. This was a way to have a pizza right in your own home, and it was wonderful. Yeah. But tell me how this all happened and how this all got started. Now the main Chef Boyardee we see on all the picture on all the cans, that was your great uncle.
That was my great uncle who founded Chef Boyardee in 1928 with my grandfather Mario and their older brother Paul. So there were three brothers that founded the company together. And all three brothers from the beginning had been immersed in the food world. So they had no formal education, and all three of them, my great-grandfather was actually a chef also in Italy. So all three of them, when they were 8 years old, they were no longer educated and they started working. So in today's terms, that's very hard to even imagine going to work as an 8-year-old child. And they basically grew up in kitchens and started by taking out the garbage or peeling potatoes or really whatever they were allowed to be doing at that age. And as the three of them grew up, they all pursued work in the food world. So my Uncle Hector was an amazing chef, and he worked in restaurants and hotels throughout Italy and throughout Europe. And my His older brother, Paul, my great uncle Paul, was the first one to come to the United States in the early 1900s, and he had started working in the Plaza Hotel and eventually worked his way up to be maitre d', which, you know, at the time, you're talking about 1917, 18. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a job that held a lot of cachet.
A lot of prestige. That was quite a position to get.
And then eventually my Uncle Hector came over. He was running the kitchen at the Plaza Hotel when he was 17 years old, which really speaks to the type of talent that he had. And my grandfather, who was the youngest, came over shortly thereafter and started working as a waiter at the Plaza, and then eventually worked his way also into the kitchen. So all three of them were really immersed in the food world. And you know, they weren't making just Italian food. They knew how to make everything, because at the time, Italian food in New York City was not what it is today. It was certainly not as chic. It was not as ubiquitous. It was probably considered, I would say, peasant food.
Right. I mean, French ruled. French cuisine, right?
Absolutely.
Especially at the Plaza.
Of course. And all of the fine restaurants were French. And you would never see a female waitress. Absolutely
right.
Not.
That meant it was a low-class mom-and-pop shop. Right?
Exactly. which, you know, obviously the world we live in today is so different. But eventually my Uncle Paul stayed at the Plaza as a maitre d'. My Uncle Hector received a job opportunity in Cleveland and moved to Cleveland. And my grandfather followed, and they started opening restaurants. And they were really introducing customers to Italian food.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, people didn't even really know the proper way to cook pasta. So they would give their customers in the restaurant a little pasta, a little tomato sauce, a little Parmesan cheese, and explain to them how to cook it at home and how to, you know, put it everything together. And customers would always come back and say, oh my gosh, I did it at home and I loved it and I love the tomato sauce. And
they would give them take home package.
Exactly.
And
they would give it. Exactly. And then from that, they said, well, what about if we started selling our sauce? And they started selling just their tomato sauce out of milk bottles in the restaurant. So out of glass milk bottles, they were selling their tomato sauce. And people loved it and kept coming back for more. And it was just like this little idea of a little takeout portion of the restaurant. And they thought, well, what about if we is there a way to expand? And sort of, do you think that people outside of this area would also enjoy our products? And how do we make that happen? And one time they had someone come through the restaurant that was delivering commodities, and they said to them, you know, as you're going across the United States, if we give you some of our sauce in milk bottles, could you just give it out to people and see if anyone would give you feedback? And and sort of created their own little test market.
Yeah.
So the truck driver was like, absolutely, sure, why not? So he, you know, went off with his milk bottles, and, you know, a month later or so came back and said, I got great feedback. Everybody loved it. And I think you guys have something. Yeah. So they thought, okay, well, now what's the next step? So the three brothers decided they're going to start this business of selling tomato sauce and canning it. And they pooled their resources and they founded what is now known as Chef Boyardee. But mm-hmm. then it was just sauce. And
so if it works in Cleveland, it'll work everywhere else. Right.
Right. Well, they felt amazing. Like, why not? Let's try it and see what happens. And by a stroke of luck, one of the customers at the Plaza Hotel was a gentleman named Mr. Hartford, who owned all of the A&P supermarkets. Oh. So my Uncle Paul went to him and said, my brothers and I are thinking about starting this company, and would you test our products on your supermarket shelves? And he said, absolutely, because he had known them for years. Uh-huh. He was familiar with their cooking, loved their food. And he said, let's do it.
Major stroke of luck.
Major stroke of luck, to be
on the shelves of the A&P supermarkets. At that time, that was, you know.
Right. At the time, the largest supermarket chain in the United States.
That's right. And now we're talking 1928.
Yeah.
So that's still, as far as any bottled sauces or, you know, canned products, that's very early.
Very early.
Yeah.
So it was timing. It was having a good product, you know, being talented, and then, you know, and also just a little bit of luck also. And it was just like all of these pieces came together.
Hmm.
And from the beginning, pretty much they had great success.
So the restaurant, you said that your uncle went and opened a restaurant in Cleveland.
Yeah.
And that stayed open all during that time that they were starting their product? Or
yes. And then what ended up happening was is that they needed to grow so many tomatoes and to keep up with their production. So Chef Boyardee actually started in Cleveland, but eventually they moved to Pennsylvania to a little town called Milton, and which was sort of this struggling steel town. And they went in, they found space for a factory. They convinced the farmers there who were growing primarily potatoes to switch their crops to tomatoes. And they were producing, they needed like 30,000 tons of tomatoes. A massive amount of tomatoes. But that factory eventually became sort of the economic backbone of the town. Hmm. And is still there today.
Interesting. And not only that, but to even devise a factory that would produce something like a food product in cans. And was it canned initially or bottled?
It was canned initially.
I saw some vintage photos of some of the old cans. I couldn't get the permission to use some of them, but it hasn't changed. Didn't change a whole lot. It was similar.
You know? It was very similar, and when you think about it in today's term, right? And you think about being 8 years old, not going to school, just working. Going straight into the workforce at 8, coming up with this idea. They never had to borrow money. The three of them, just took every penny that they had and started this company. And even having not just in terms of food, they were all three just highly also intelligent.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, they made it.
So, and they made it all on their own. So it's just, I always think it's just a great American success story.
So the factory is still there in Milton, Pennsylvania. Yeah. Oh, well, but then bring us up to date in today's world, and that they sold. Well, first of all, they got a big contract to produce even more once World War II came around, right?
Right. So World War II starts, and the U.S. government decides that they, aside from the rations that they are already producing, they wanted to come up with something that was more of like a typical American breakfast for their soldiers. So they wanted to find a way to put some potatoes, a slice of ham, an egg in a can or in a ration. And eventually they gave it to two companies first and they couldn't come up with the formula. And the third opportunity came to Chef Boyardee, and my Uncle Hector, with a chalkboard, figured out the formula in 30 days' time. And they received the commission from the U.S. government to produce all of the rations for World War II. So at that time, the factory then converts from civilian production, which would be supermarket production, to wartime production, and was running 24 hours a day. And producing all of rations for American soldiers and also for Russia. And so it was just a huge undertaking. For them, and also something that they were extremely proud to be a part of and to be doing, because they felt that they came to the United States really looking for opportunity, and they had received so much opportunity here, and they really wanted to give back, and they felt like this was an amazing way to give back, not just a great opportunity for them, but they felt extremely proud to be part of helping.
Well, and as you said, it became the backbone of that community. The numbers of people that they employed for that factory, I'm sure, were in the hundreds.
Yeah.
All right. Tell me about the name change. We know it as Chef Boyardee, right. But the name is Boyardee, and it's spelled differently: Boiardi.
Right. So when they were coming up with the name, they said, well, they were very proud of their name and they wanted to keep their name, but they, a lot of vowels tends to be confusing for Americans.
No one could pronounce it right.
So they felt like if no one is going to be able to pronounce the name, how are they going to remember it and how are they going to ask for it? So it's the phonetic spelling that's on the can, which was done purposely just to make it easier to pronounce
and
for
that
Americans.
Was brilliant, because that whole and the whole xenophobic kind of thing about buying something with a strange name attached to it. I mean, if you have it so simple as Boyardee, and then of course Madison Avenue took off on that, right? And the advertising that played up to that was brilliant. That was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. Yeah. And who would have thought that there really is a person, Boyardee? And there you go. That is pretty amazing, and sound like amazing people to have accomplished all that. So after World War II, they continued. They really expanded their brand too. I mean, it wasn't just, what was the first product? The sauce.
The first product was the sauce. So they had a tomato sauce. They had a mushroom sauce, and they had like a spicier sauce. And that's how they started. And then eventually it went into spaghetti, and not necessarily in a can. One was in a box. So you would get dried spaghetti, and then you'd have a little can of sauce and then a little can of Parmesan cheese. And when they started Chef Boyardee, they were the largest importers of olive oil and Parmesan cheese in the United States.
Well, you could not. I mean, it was not available anyplace else.
Right.
They were probably the only importers.
And they were growing all their own mushrooms and their own tomatoes. And you know, what happened during World War II and thereafter is that it was also the right timing in history, because suddenly, you know, during the war, women had reentered the workforce because the men were fighting overseas.
Right.
And they needed food that was convenient and fast and relatively inexpensive. So it was also a great product, and it fit all of those needs at that time. Post-World War II, they had to convert the factory back to civilian production, and at the time they decided, we've had so much success, and their priority was to make sure that everyone around them was okay, so that everyone that had jobs would continue to have jobs and that the factory would continue to thrive. And they knew that they were going to need money for marketing, and they thought, what's the best way to do this and to expand? So what they did was they sold the company to a company called American Home Products.
And this was...
this was like 1943 about. Mm. So they sold the company for X amount of stock and X amount of cash, and they stayed on to consult. And that company, besides having a large food segment, grew to be like one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the United States.
Mm.
So that was just another huge windfall for them, is that then this company that they became part of also became such a large corporation. But they really stayed on. I mean, they stayed on for, you know, a few decades, and still even my Uncle Hector, you know, did commercials, you know, later. I was in a commercial when I was two. So it was like he was always sort of part of it, but just had taken a back seat.
Well, your Uncle Hector is the face that's on the can.
He is
right?
The face that's on the can. Yeah.
Great. And that they did change that at one point to reflect his aging.
Yeah.
I think the black mustache became gray.
Exactly.
But it was, I mean, it was still him. And people, I think to this day, didn't realize, you know, it's just a new label. They didn't realize it was a real person.
It was a real person.
Yeah. Interesting. Because we see, as I say, Betty Crocker. Everyone thinks Betty Crocker's a real person. You know?
Right.
She's not a real person, but did a show on that. then when did they first start putting the spaghetti in the cans with the, or the ravioli? I think ravioli was one of their biggest.
Ravioli
sellers,
was one
right?
of the biggest.
Yeah.
That came later. So
yeah.
The ravioli, I think came after the war. And I have gone back and found pizza boxes that came out in the 50s. They also had a frozen pizza for a while during the 50s. And they just, the food line just sort of kept evolving.
Mm-hmm. For better or for worse,
for
one
better,
might
for
say.
Worse.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, when they started, could they have ever have predicted, oh, in, you know, now the company's, I guess, it's going to be 87 years old. So could they have predicted in 87 years it's going to be $1 billion company? Never in a million years. No. I mean, that was way beyond their dreams.
They could have big dreams, but probably not that big,
no.
Right? Yeah. Interesting. Well, I want to find out more about the family involvement and the products when we come back after a short break.
You are listening to I Love the Way by Alan Wilkes.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Kane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to kane5.com.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, we're back, and we're talking about Italian food in a can, none other than Chef Boyardee. And you know, Anna, we were talking during the break, and when I mentioned to some friends, they wanted to know what my next show was about, and I told them, ooh, it's about Chef Boyardee. It's going to be fun. They go, oh, as a kid, I always loved SpaghettiOs. Well, folks, SpaghettiOs, if you remember the can, that was Franco-American and not Chef Boyardee. I'm sure that must happen a lot, right?
All the time. And, you know, as you and I were talking before, I think people, actually, when they think of Italian food in a can, they automatically think Chef Boyardee.
Chef Boyardee, of course.
And, you know, so we take it as a compliment because, you know, Chef Boyardee was, you know, the first one. And there's always somebody there to copy and I guess that's the biggest compliment, right?
Indeed.
Somebody wants to do what you're doing.
Right. Well, and you said, you know, the food, as time went on, the food evolved. And I said, for better or for worse, meaning that, you know, processed foods are all over the supermarket shelves, the good and the bad. And there's a place for them at times. There's always, you know, a quick meal. But people, of course, these days, we've broken away from that and trying to eat more healthfully and having fresh foods and not the processed ready-made foods. So there's been a kind of a pulling away from that, and mm-hmm. I'm sure that I don't know whether I'm sure that's affected sales in many of these lines. Is any of the family still involved? I mean, the company is now ConAgra.
ConAgra, and No one's directly involved with the company except for me occasionally. Like, they do a lot of charity initiatives and donate incredible amounts of food and resources to ending childhood hunger. So if it's that type of initiative, then I get involved.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, everyone sort of took different paths.
Well, I guess, you know, but your forefathers set you up nicely so that you could, it allowed you to take a different path, which was very nice. But you kind of went back into that path recently,
right.
A couple of years ago. You published a book called Delicious Memories. And in this book, there are a lot of the recipes that eventually went into a can, right?
Right. So I think it would be impossible to grow up in my family and not love good food and not have an appreciation for good food. And food was certainly much bigger than a family business in our family. It was really the thing that connected us and the way that we lived our traditions. I was born in Italy, so it's just in the DNA. It's impossible to get away from that. And I started teaching a cooking class. I never charged anybody. It was only for fun. And because what I had sort of found, like, among my friends is that their basic skill set had been lost. I mean, I grew up in a family where everybody cooks. Even, mm-hmm. you know, my dad is an amazing cook. My mom is amazing. And everyone just lives in the kitchen together. I mean, that's really the heart of the home. And so I started doing this class, and people would just always ask me, about the story of my family and our recipes. And I was teaching a lot of our recipes in the class. And my husband said, why don't you do a book? And I had, it was really something that I had never thought about doing. And I said, you know, I sort of thought it over and I said, okay, you know, if anything, I would love to preserve this history just for my children and my grandchildren. Sure. And my dad is 87 years old, and I wanted to sort of, you know, preserve these stories before he forgot them all. And so I thought, you know what, I'm going to do it as just a labor of love. If nobody buys the book, I really don't care. I'm just doing it for myself. And when I went, I put together this whole folder and you know, wrote some samples from the book and some sample recipes and some photos. And I went around to a few different publishers, and there was so much interest in the book because obviously it was such an iconic brand, and it's right. Just this incredible story. And so I wrote the book, and some of the recipes in the book also are just my recipes that I've tweaked and sort of make sense in a modern day life. But a lot of the recipes are germane to Piacenza, which is where I was born, and mm-hmm. which is also where my grandfather was
born. That's what I was going to ask you. What part of Italy did they come? So we're talking, yeah.
So Piacenza is in the north in the Emilia-Romagna region, where I think we have the best food in Italy.
I will agree with you.
So it's a lot of things that are very specific to Piacenza, like tortelli, which is it's a stuffed pasta, but you really don't find it even in Italy outside of Piacenza. Mm. Like, we make it in a very specific way. And then all these recipes that I grew up with that, you know, are family favorites in terms of, like, they're my grandfather's tomato sauce and a dish from Piacenza, which is called pizzare e fazer, which is a pasta and bean dish. You know, there's all different types of pastas. We don't have a lot of fish because where Piacenza is, we're not close to water. So fish is, you know, food is very regional in Italy. So that's not part of our immediate cuisine there. But it's just a lot of great pasta and vegetable dishes and
I have to say that I'm sorry to put in there, but the book is that they are mouthwatering recipes, and the photographs, you know, show you that it's home cooking. You can tell it's really home cooking. It's not some of these books, you know, that everything looks so gorgeous saying, well, how could I ever reproduce this dish? You know, but it looks very much like food in someone's home, in your Italian grandmother's home.
Yeah, I mean, I think really at the heart, Italian food is not really overcomplicated food. It's just, you know, it's about starting with some like really fresh ingredients and a good olive oil.
That's right. Get the best ingredients, going to give you the best flavor. Don't overdo that. You know, don't overdo it on sauces. Sauces aren't cooked for days in, days out. Yeah, that's what a lot of people don't understand. I think Italian food is finally having its day too. That people realize this is the base of really fine food.
Right. Just
the best ingredients. Yeah.
I agree.
Guess that was an easy one. Okay, so tell me which of the recipes, and I'm sorry, I don't have the book in front of me here, but which recipes were the ones that were, are there some that are authentic, like trademarked recipes, or?
Well, we never went so far as to formally trademark them, but there is the tomato sauce that was mm-hmm. served at all of my, you know, in my Uncle Hector's restaurants, and a lot of recipes for fresh homemade pasta, and then the lasagna recipe, which is really a family favorite and is a little bit different than how you typically find lasagna now in a restaurant, because there's no ricotta in it. It's very thin homemade pasta with a bechamel.
And I'm picturing it right now because I saw the picture of it.
And that was a favorite, uh-huh. A restaurant favorite, you know, and not every day. They would only maybe make it once a week because it was labor intensive and it was mm-hmm. really special, but it was for sure a favorite. And so that's in the book. And it's still actually like all of the recipes in the book are all of my favorites. And I'm trying to think what other, you know, it's funny because one of the commercials that I was in with my grandfather, we actually shot in Genova. And when my Uncle Hector would travel back to Italy and my grandfather, they would sort of get off the boat there. And the first thing that they would do, because they typically traveled by boat, is the first thing that they would do is they would go get a plate of linguine with pesto, because the best pesto comes from the Liguria region mm-hmm. in Italy, because we consider that the best basil, and you know, it's, you pretty much only find it in the summer, and it's it has to be very small and tender. And that was one of the first things that they would always do. And in our family, we always make basil in the summertime and then we freeze it. So that recipe is also in the book. So a lot of the recipes, even if they weren't specific to the restaurant, they were specific to the way that I was raised and all sort of have a family story attached.
That's wonderful. Yeah. And that's your mother you're cooking next to, I see.
That's
in
my
a couple
mom.
Pictures. Yeah. So I mean, the apple didn't fall far from the tree, right? She's always there cooking. Wonderful stories. Now, if I make this lasagna for my family, very foodie family, and say, if we're having Chef Boyardee lasagna tonight, I'm sure I could hear all kinds of moans and groans until they realize that it's the original recipe. It's,
right.
I mean, and as I say, everyone, there's a time and a place for
exactly.
some of these convenience foods, and now they have the microwavable Chef Boyardee.
Right, which is very popular cans. Among college students.
I'm sure, you know, that microwave, and it's just one portion size.
Yeah.
But it's nice to see that they came from the actual recipes, you know, that are in the can and in the product, come from things that are based on very good food, and kind of ruined ravioli in a way for a lot of people, I think, in a sense. Not sorry to
say.
Well,
you know what's funny is that it's amazing how, and I'm being very serious when I say this, is that it's amazing how many people will say to me, you know, and these are sophisticated people, right, that eat at the best restaurants, they're like, you know, one of my favorite things to this day is still Chef Boyardee ravioli out of a can.
it's that
sensory
memory.
Right,
absolutely.
Right, that brings them back to like being a child or being in college, and it takes them right back there.
Right.
Which is really kind of funny.
Yeah, it is. Oh, but I understand it perfectly. I mean, I can taste it, right? You know, close my eyes and taste it. And yes, I used to give my kids a can of it every now and then because I was in a hurry. They grew up just fine. Nothing wrong with that. And I mean, you know, of all of the junk food that's out there, this you can't call this junk food. I mean, it's food that's processed, you know, with high heat and what you do to it. I mean, there aren't all these stabilizers and other ingredients in it. It's the natural foods that, you know, that were just exposed to high heat to can and preserve. And they tasted, you know, unfortunately that does alter a taste of a fresh pasta, you know, fresh tomato sauce on a pasta, but it was still good food.
Yeah, I mean, they're always, and still to this day, are have a lot of initiatives to lower sodium, and like they're very attuned to the fact that it's you know, food that's made for children, and they put out a lot, like ConAgra puts out a lot of recipes that they have different chefs working on, where they're saying, well, if you're going to give your kids food out of a can, here are also recipes, and here you can add fresh tomatoes or lettuce or kidney beans to up the protein content and sort of give them a way to make it more nutritious for their kids and give them, you know, options.
Yeah, well, I think that's very important too, because that's the whole battle, is teaching people to cook. And obviously time is a factor, but we've raised a couple of generations now of people who just don't really step foot in the kitchen and cook. So hopefully we've turned that around a bit. And you know, it's quite amazing too when you think with this whole industry that your grandfather and uncle started, that I mean, pasta, dried pasta, the first dried pasta wasn't even produced in this country until practically the end of the 19, like 1890-something, 1892, I think, in Staten Island, as a matter of fact, that there was not even dried pasta here. It was, as you said, Italian food was unknown, really, until it became there more restaurants in the 40s and 50s, but they were forebears.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's funny because I don't know if they're familiar with polenta, which is an Italian dish made out of cornmeal. And I remember, because as a kid when I'd go to school after school, I also had to go to Italian school, so I would learn about Italian history and culture and geography, and you know, I just remember this as a kid, is one, we always had polenta in the winter time. I mean, that was something that was really popular in our family. But polenta is really, in Italy, was considered like a peasant food because it was basically water and cornmeal. So there wasn't a lot in terms of like cost or ingredients. And sometimes when I go to restaurants and I see what they charge for a plate of polenta, it's yeah, I start laughing, right? Because they took something that was really like the, you know, you can pretend that it's chic and all this, but really, I mean, this is what people like eat in the mountains.
But if it's done right, and especially delicious. If it's served with a great stew of some, you know, wild game, I can't think of a better winter dish.
No.
That's wonderful. They didn't put that in a can, I noticed.
No.
That didn't make
They probably thought that was too foreign a concept for Americans.
And I'm sure it would have been, right? Well, Anna, thank you so much. It's been just a delightful story, and it's making me really hungry. And
you.
I must say, those pizzas I made from pizza mix, from the Chef Boyardee pizza mix, I'm sure I haven't had one for, you know, we won't say how many years, but I'm sure I wouldn't find it tasting quite the same. But it was impressive to me at the time.
And the pizza kit was one of my first forays into the kitchen. It just happened to have our last name on it. But, you know, like some kids have an Easy Bake Oven. The pizza kit was my favorite thing to make. And my mom would, you know, roll out the dough and I would use the tomato sauce, and then she would let us put whatever we wanted on top. And I loved the pizzas.
Yeah. Hey, listen, so, it introduced me to it too. I mean, you know, it was great. And who knows how many budding chefs started out by making Chef Boyardee pizza. You never know.
You never know.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And I just want to remind people that if you find the book, it's still available. Yeah,
it's only a couple
years old.
You can find it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
It's called Delicious Memories by Anna Boyardee. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And you've been listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.